kulture sećanja u dijalogu. Slušate podcast Fonda za humanitarno pravo.
This is Memory Cultures in Dialogue podcast of the Humanitarian Law Center. My name is Jelena Đurejinović. In this episode, we are discussing some questions many of us dealing with post-conflict societies have thought of. How does violence occur within communities that lived together in peace for a long time? Does memory of violence in previous historical periods play a role in this? I am very happy to welcome Mila Dragojević as today's guest. Mila is the Associate Professor in Politics at Sevani, University of the South in the United States. Her first book, The Politics of Social Ties, Immigrants in an Ethnic Homeland, examined the political behavior and mobilization of refugees from Croatia and Bosnia in Serbia. Today, I'm really happy to have the opportunity to talk about her second book, A Moral Community's Collective Crimes in Time of War, which was published with Cornell University Press this year. This groundbreaking study examines local-level violence against civilians, taking Croatia in the 90s and Uganda and Guatemala in the 80s as case studies. Hello, Mila. Thank you for finding time to join me for this talk.
Hello, Jelena. Thank you for inviting me. It is my pleasure.
We often observe the 90s wars in former Yugoslavia in isolation from other conflicts in the world. Your research involves cross-national comparison between Croatia, Uganda, and Guatemala. Why did you choose specifically these case studies?
Well, first of all, I have much more expertise in the Balkans because I'm originally from Croatia, but also I have studied over the course of my research and also doctoral studies the region of the Balkans. So that was my primary area of expertise. And I was already familiar with some of the questions and some of the issues that I wanted to study. But I also am a trained comparativist or person in comparative politics. And we always try to find some sort of factors that may be helpful in understanding what specifically might lead to violence in some place, for example, in this case, violence against civilians in some parts of the world or in some parts of the same country, and then compare it with others. But the reason I chose these cases specifically is because they are vastly different in terms of national, historical, and cultural factors. But what they have in common is that there was targeted violence against civilians on the basis of ethnic, regional, and political identities during wartime. And so this was an important comparison because of the very different histories. In the cases of Guatemala and Uganda, we have colonial history, which is not present in the case of Croatia, but we do have the kind of insurgency taking place and we see the targeted violence. So that's kind of a shorter answer. In the case of Croatia, it was also, there is another type of comparison within the book, and the book is mainly focusing on the case of Croatia in the 90s. I was interested in understanding conditions under which civilians may be targeted on the local level, subnationally, and there was significant variation within Croatia. And so that was a within country comparison and then a cross national comparison.
Maybe for the beginning, to kind of lead into the more complex questions, could you maybe reflect a little bit for us about your experience of doing fieldwork, which you did in all these countries? And how it was for you also to talk to people about their experiences of war and violence?
Well, I would say that is a pretty complex question to begin with. In fact, without fieldwork, there would be no study. The fieldwork and the interviews are the essential component of this work. And I would first of all have to say that without the kind of support that I received in the field from both my colleagues initially, and then later the different research assistants in different regions, this would have been impossible because it's very, very challenging to conduct research on this topic for many reasons. And one of the main reasons is that this is obviously a very painful topic for people who experienced war and firsthand violence. And so many of them are just not really do not wish to go back and remember some of these difficult moments. And some of them frankly do not trust people coming from outside and asking these very sensitive questions. So it took a long time to establish trust and to show that this research was about really understanding what happened and really taking the interviews very, very seriously. In fact, this is one intention I had throughout the book, is to show my respondents, not just as subjects of research, but as teachers, our teachers, of what we can learn about what factors lead to escalation of conflict and eventual violence in some parts of their country. And then to understand really what people went through, not only before, but during, and then since these interviews took place many years after the wars happened. So you can see that the effects, based on some of these statements in the book, have been long lasting, and that is often also unrecognized in the literature. So yeah, the experience of fieldwork was both challenging but also essential, and it was essential to learn about the issues I was writing about. I also would have to say that all of these respondents were very courageous to share and to go back to remembering some of these difficult moments. I also think that the timing of the interview vis-a-vis when the wars happened in each of these contexts was important, because substantial time has passed in all of the cases. So people were able to spend some time analyzing and thinking about what happened. It wasn't immediate, you know, post-conflict kind of response, but people had some time to think about. And again, these interviews were not used in terms of understanding exactly what happened, where and how, but it was about people's interpretations of how they understood the conditions leading up to violence. So the bulk of fieldwork is conducted in Croatia from 2013 to 14, and these were 131 interviews, in-depth interviews. I also collected archival sources across 8 different regions that I was comparing in Croatia. And then in central Uganda in 2015, I conducted 36 interviews with help of local research assistants. And in western Guatemala in 2016, 18 interviews. And without, again, research assistance, this would have been impossible in such a short, relatively short time to conduct research on 3 different continents. In case of Uganda and Guatemala, I was present in all the interviews. In cases of Croatia, I had several groups of people working and I joined them occasionally, but I was not able to be present physically in all of the interviews.
I must say that I was really impressed by your approach and understanding of your respondents as teachers, which is really interesting, as opposed to, you know, going to different regions for so-called data harvesting. As I said, I was really impressed by that approach to all of your respondents, even though that you didn't do all of your fieldwork on your own, but you also had assistance. But maybe to move on to more conceptual approach of your research, you introduced the concept of amoral communities. What are they?
Very important question. So this concept I developed after, it is not entirely a new concept. It builds on the literature of nationalism. And so the essential idea comes from, of course, as you can tell in the title, I'm definitely inspired by Imagined Communities of Benedict Anderson, but also of other scholars like Foucault and Esposito, Hannah Arendt, and so on, many others who wrote on related topics. The idea is that this is, space which can, so amoral community doesn't apply to a country as a whole, a nation as a whole, but a particular region, a particular time and place in a country, within a country, where individuals are not free to express themselves or act on the basis of their personal views, if those views do not align with one of the dominant political views or narratives that have been imposed. And so that's the essential, not being free to actually express yourself, your own view, but feeling that you always have to take the side of what is imposed on you. And the second is that within those spaces and times, the definition of crime in terms of collective crimes, and I'll define that in a bit just shortly, the definition of crime becomes altered by these conditions of war or this state of exception or the state of emergency under which the violence becomes something that is justified by authorities as a form of preemptive security or defense against perceived threats. And these threats are not against one's own biological existence, like yours in self-defense situation, being immediately attacked, but to the existence, and this is where it connects with Arne Anderson's points, the existence of one's ethnically defined state, seen as the extension of one's life. So this is, in short, how I, it's a maybe complex concept, but it is really a concept within which this national identity and then the lack of freedom to separate from that imposed political view is present. And then maybe I should just say right away then, because I mentioned the collective crimes, to the way that I define collective crimes is targeting of individuals and their immediate social and cultural environment on the basis of these newly created identities. And these newly created identities combined political and ethnic components. And I call this term political ethnicity.
How does this connect to the emergence of violence in some communities? In other words, why does it happen in some and then doesn't happen in others within the same larger national community or a state?
There are several processes that take place that, so we already know from the literature on nationalism, both in history and in political science, that leaders, political leaders, often engage in this nationalist political mobilization, which link political and ethnic identity. So this is nothing new. Where my book adds something maybe not entirely also new, but something a little more specified, is how does that national level discourse then map onto the local level divisions? You know, how do these local level divisions then actually happen? And there are two conditions that I have. So I do recognize that this begins from the top, but then on the local level, there have to be two different conditions that I have identified over the course of these interviews and research. And one is the exclusion of moderates from the political and social space through violence, threats, and social ostracism as one of the milder forms, but more pervasive forms, especially in the beginning. And then the second condition is the production of borders. And what I mean by that is some type of physical separation of population that takes place initially through barricades or checkpoints, and then later through wartime dividing lines, and then even state borders, if those become, you know, further recognized as dividing as states, different states. So the two conditions are then exclusion of moderates and the production of borders that make these processes, these are the two processes that make it possible for amoral communities to emerge or develop.
Slušate podcast Fonda za humanitarno pravo. Kulture sećanja u dijalogu.
Could you maybe, for a better understanding by some of our listeners who might not be familiar with the context of the three countries you're studying, could you maybe elaborate a bit on these conditions on one of the examples from your research?
And I actually would be happy to kind of show you a little bit in all three briefly. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Croatia, even before the war started, in some communities, it was very, very difficult to remain, specifically in some communities, it was difficult to remain neutral or not to take sides. In the case of Croatia, it was Serb and Croat side of the conflict. Even though in many of these regions that I examined, the dividing lines between ethnicities were not very sharp. In fact, there were a lot of intermarriages, there were a lot of connections, especially if you think of one region, Eastern Slavonia, which is actually my home region, that region being so close to actually Bosnia and Serbia and then Hungary has a lot of ethnic diversity. And so to divide the whole population in this kind of binary way, it seemed unthinkable before the first cases of violence. And so what I was comparing is, for example, this particular region with Gorski Kotar, which is also a multi-ethnic region of Croatia, where the violence didn't take these kind of proportions. So the situation was very different in Eastern Slavonia. In Gorski Kotar, right in the beginning, there were successful communications across different barricades. There also were barricades, just like in Eastern Slavonia in the summer of 91. But one of the activists, Franjo Starčević, and others who were trying to build communication and peace in the region, succeeded in actually removing the barricades and not having the population be physically divided in the way that unfortunately happened in Eastern Slavonia. The first barricades that were set up in Eastern Slavonia were set up in May of 91 already, after the violence and killing of 12 Croatian policemen in Borovo Selo. And after that, one of the moderate police chief in Osijek, Josip Brajhukir, tried to negotiate with Serbs and Croats in these villages to remove the barricades and to establish lines of communication. But unfortunately, that summer he was killed by the Croat extremists, for whom this moderate stance represented a threat. And so that and many other kind of killings, and also the fact that from Serbia there were volunteer units present in this region under the leadership of Vojislav Šešelj, the president of the nationalist oriented, at the time opposition party, the Serbian Radical Party in Serbia, arrived. They started arriving even before Borovo Selo incident in April of 91. And also the media on both sides contributed to this. So there were tensions that were rising slowly. And then the first instances of violence then led to further tensions, and then these barricades. And then there were cases of disappearance, mm-hmm. and no further investigation. That then contributed to fear and the sense of uncertainty. And some of my respondents said in this period and in this area, based on what they felt, they remember this well. Nobody was able to protect oneself, regardless of one's ethnicity. You were afraid to cross these barricades because you didn't know if you would be used as a human shield or if you would be kidnapped and disappear. So there was a kind of sense of nobody's there to protect you, really. You have to take care of yourself. And that's when it was easier to divide people further and to even justify the use of violence under these particular conditions. If you look at Uganda, similar kind of things were happening. One respondent was particularly interesting because he said that he was able to be neutral. He went from rebel-controlled territories to government-controlled territories, because in Uganda the rebels opposed the government, and they actually ended up winning the war in that case. Because of his job, he was able to cross, and he said that was very rare. Most people didn't have that freedom. And people who crossed were seen as suspicious by both sides. They were seen as spies. And people didn't trust. One of the respondents said there were disappearances, and that also contributed, just like in Croatia, to fear and distrust. This respondent said, your very brother could betray you. We were told not to trust even your very shadow. So you can see how this situation builds up over time to divide people. And violence is used not just to silence the moderates and to exclude them, but also to actually divide people, including civilians, into two camps. Violence, you have these physical boundaries and that gradual exclusion of anyone who wants to have a more moderate, neutral stance, trying to build bridges across the divided communities. And then in Guatemala, the last example, you had in very early, first of all, that's a completely different conflict, also from Uganda and Croatia, but it lasted for 36 years overall. So it's very, very long-standing war. Unfortunately, because of the kind of inequalities that also were racial and economic, there was a closing off of non-violent political routes for political action and change for those who wanted to create a country that is a little more democratic, a little more inclusive, a little more equal. And then over time, those opposed to this kind of segregated and in unequal society were criminalized more and more. And that led to growth of this kind of use of more violence to rebel and to try to challenge the system. But then there were some processes that were happening on a local level that made it impossible for people in these especially tight-knit rural communities to remain neutral, because they would say, if you're part of this community, or you are with us, or you're with them. And, you know, that rejecting, one of the respondents said, a place where your grandparents lived, your parents lived all their life. It was very, very difficult to make that choice, especially these are very poor communities, and they had no way to survive outside of these villages, for example, in this case, Western Highlands of Guatemala. So it was very, and then on the other hand, they had pressures from the military. But again, it's a very different historical situation and very different dynamic. But then when you look at particular processes like the disappearances, the threats, and then the actual physical borders dividing the communities, those were very, very comparable.
Because this podcast focuses quite a lot on memory and memory cultures, I would like to turn to the notion of historical memory and how it features in your research. In other words, what is the role of memory for these processes of ethnicization, polarization, and mobilization in the context of local communities?
And here is where, so this is specifically, I talk about it throughout the book, but especially in chapter 5, where I go and actually I had a question that I asked to each one of my respondents about whether they and how do they think that past waves of violence matter for what happened in that more recent at the time period of violence. But let me just begin by saying that what I find is that, first of all, memories are not something, the memories or the past waves of violence do not predetermine the future wave of the violence. In other words, future waves of violence are not inevitable just because there was violence in the past. So this is one thing that I find. And in that sense, that very much is complementary to existing studies of scholars in memory studies. But again, just like in a complementary way, I also find that memories can be used for political mobilization. And collective memories do play an important role. And I see that in interviews, because a lot of my respondents mentioned the specific past waves of violence and the way that either mattered or did not matter to them. So that certainly there is evidence in these interviews that this was used as a political mobilization tool. So I would say the memories matter because they are part of that repertoire of political discourse that leaders use. But again, they do not explain, or this repertoire or this discourse does not explain why violence happens in some places and not in others. It also doesn't explain why amoral communities form somewhere and not in other places. So that's when, and the reason that this doesn't explain it is because I saw great variation in how respondents interpreted past waves of violence. Even in places with extensive violence, some of the respondents said that it had nothing to do with current waves, you know, of what's happening in particular context. And there's this broad variation doesn't lead us to make some kind of causal argument that this particular past leads to some future violence. So what does then explain it? And that's when I turn back to these local level conditions. So it is exactly when the moderates excluded and when people are divided, then using past in political mobilization seems to resonate more with people in those particular places. So it is really those, again, going back to the beginning of discussion of what conditions lead to formation of amoral communities, those are also the conditions that make it possible for memory to be a tool for political mobilization.
Just to kind of finish on a slightly positive note, your book also involves some implications for efforts to prevent violence against civilians in the future, including, for example, demilitarization of peacekeeping. Could you maybe a bit elaborate on that for the end? of our talk.
And I think, again, this is the whole point of writing and working on this, is because I don't believe that any of this violence against civilians is something inevitable, and it can be prevented, and it can be certainly with our knowledge and knowing these conditions, we can provide space for people to act and organize and try to de-escalate the conflict. So in the end, I talk about peacemaking and peacekeeping efforts, and often the peacekeepers tend to divide people into territories that have been either conquered by a particular army, or their main idea is, if this population is fighting, let's just divide them and keep them divided. And actually, that might be counterintuitive, but that's what I would argue is precisely exacerbating the conflict. And it could create further conditions for more violence, especially the violence in which civilians could be the targets. And the reason for that is that people, by being put into these camps or certain areas where they are supposed to be safe, are actually exposed more, because they are more vulnerable. Their freedom of movement is limited, so they can't go. If they disagree with something, that they have no choice but to either follow the order or die. So it's really a very, very dire circumstance for people who are put into these kind of arrangements. You know, especially, I would think this would be especially applicable to refugee camps or any type of safe zones, we call them, where people are. And often those are arranged and agreed on in peace agreements. So what would be the solution if people are fighting? Well, if there is a necessity to create something temporary, there have to be a lot of measures in place to prevent the kind of violence, and then to eventually open the borders to people for free movement. It's essential, because that only free movement is compatible with free thinking, and free thinking is essential for avoiding the kind of radicalization that leads to the formation of amoral communities. So certainly there is something we can do to prevent this.
Thank you again, Mila, for joining me for this discussion. This was Mila Dragojevic talking about her new book, Amoral Communities, Collective Crimes in the Time of War, which was published with the Cornell University Press this year and can also be bought at with some European distributors. This was Memory Cultures in Dialogue, the podcast of the Humanitarian Law Center from Belgrade.
Slušali ste podcast Fonda za humanitarno pravo.